Lots of Americans are dreading their next rent or mortgage payment.
We know that there will be a housing crisis as a result of the pandemic.
We don't have the funds to pay for the 3 months that we've missed as a whole, so now we are curious and nervous and slightly confused about the options going forward.
I'm facing eviction next month, and my industry won't rebound for months or maybe years.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, June 24th, as the pandemic continues, Americans are bracing for a wave of possible evictions.
More than 10 million households were spending over half of their income on rent even before the pandemic.
Also on the show, Long Day's election in tonight in Kentucky and New York. We'll talk about the role absentee ballots are playing in each of those states.
We have a whole lot of ballots still coming in, and we won't know the actual results until next week.
A lot to get to, plus your calls at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But first... evictions and foreclosures are looming large across the United States as state and federal protections for renters and homeowners that were issued at the height of the coronavirus pandemic are quickly expiring. In late March, as the unemployment rate skyrocketed and COVID-19 peaked in parts of the country, the government banned evictions for federally backed housing and also provided financial relief to millions of people through the CARES Act, both of which will expire later this summer. But the federal moratorium doesn't cover most renters. That responsibility falls on the states. And there's been a patchwork of temporary policies put in place to protect renters so far. In California, for example, the eviction moratorium has been extended through July 28th. But in other states like New York, the eviction moratorium has already expired. And housing rights groups estimate that 50 to 60,000 eviction cases could be filed in New York City's housing courts in the coming days. And like COVID-19 itself, this housing insecurity is expected to disproportionately impact Black and Latino communities across the country. For more on what's happening with housing in the U.S., we turn to Elena McCargo, Vice President of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute, and Jenny Schutz, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And Jenny says we're likely to see a wave of evictions in the coming weeks and months.
The future is potentially pretty bad, but it depends a lot on what governments choose to do over the next, say, 2 months. Housing insecurity was actually a widespread problem even before the pandemic. So more than 10 million households were spending over half of their income on rent before this occurred. That means that people really had no financial cushion, couldn't accumulate any kind of savings, and were living pretty much on the edge paycheck to paycheck even before this hit. So there are a lot of people who really have no cushion to weather the storm, and many of them have been relying very heavily on the stimulus checks or on the expanded unemployment insurance benefits, which are set to run out in addition to the eviction moratoria. So there are two things that matter there, both the legal protections that keep tenants in their home, but also very crucially, the financial assistance that the federal government has been providing.
Elena, tell me what you're seeing right now when it comes to the potential for Americans to be evicted from their homes in the coming weeks and months.
There are some protections that were put in place federally and locally that have really helped us shield from the wave, or at least delay the potential for eviction through moratoria and some of the support that came through the CARES Act. We kind of look at it as a cliff, and that once that those supports go away, if the jobs haven't come back or if the incomes haven't been restored, we are really facing a serious, significant problem in the rental markets. And then I have to just add that it's also an issue on the homeownership side of things as well, as people are facing and missing their mortgage payments at a higher rate right now.
Right. We're not just talking about renters. We're also talking about homeowners whose mortgages are also going to become due if they were issued some sort of break during the peak of the pandemic. And Elena, you know, because of that, we know that housing and racial segregation in this country are intertwined. I'm wondering if you can tell us what communities might most be affected by this cliff coming up, whether they're homeowners or renters. Are we looking largely at communities of color, women, certain geographic areas?
The census has been doing a pretty large scale survey called the Census Pulse survey of households, very, very specifically on housing, looking at some questions of stability. So were you able to pay your mortgage last month? Were you able to pay your rent last month? What do you think your prospects are for being able to pay it next month? And just getting a feel or a pulse from people about where or how stable they feel in their housing situation right now. And one of the things that we have in this data is the ability to look at this by race and, you know, so some demographic characteristics as well as income. But when you look at this along racial lines, just like when you look at the unemployment data, we are seeing significant amounts of unemployment in the Latino and Black communities that is directly aligning with what we're hearing in this the Pulse data that's telling us that these families, Black and Latino renters, are having more difficulty paying their rent. Black and Latino homeowners are having more difficulty paying their mortgages. And then we haven't even yet touched on the fact that, you know, there's also some, there's landlords and people built into a lot of these numbers and metrics that we're still looking to kind of analyze and understand, because as people are unable to pay their rents, that really causes problems for landlords as well, who are trying to pay mortgages in some cases, or just to sustain those properties. And so there's a whole system of issues here that really need attention. And I think that the conversations and the calls for rent relief that really provide support and relief for not only tenants, but also for landlords, I think are real. And we really need to be taking a look at that and having some urgency around putting those in place before these moratoria and these other benefits expire.
Elena, you laid out some very important points there. Jenny, I'll get back to you for a second, because you both mentioned the CARES Act. Did the CARES Act cover all renters? Did it cover just some renters? Did it have any provisions in there for homeowners?
The CARES Act has more protections for homeowners than for renters, and really a minority of renters are covered. So one thing that the CARES Act did, and then subsequent actions related to that that were undertaken by the Federal Housing Finance Agency, was to say that borrowers who have a mortgage that's backed by the federal government through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac have up to a year to pay their mortgage. And so that's actually quite a long period of time of forbearance for not just for homeowners, but for landlords who have a federally backed mortgage. So this was a pretty sweeping provision of protection for people who have a mortgage. Unfortunately, the federal government really has very limited tools to protect renters who live in unsubsidized private housing. And most renters in the U.S., including most low-income renters, don't live in subsidized housing and don't get subsidies from the federal government. But the way the U.S. has decided to structure regulation of the rental market, most of that really resides in the states. So states are the ones that set up these sort of landlord-tenant protection laws. And states also decide what local governments can do to add protections on top of that. So we really see a longstanding imbalance where the federal government is very involved in the homeownership market through regulating mortgages, but plays a very limited role in the rental market, meaning that we just don't have tools available to provide kind of blanket tenant protections to renters in a case like this.
Elena mentioned protests for rent relief. And I'm wondering, Jenny, to your point about the states really having control over the rental market and those protections. Now, we can't obviously go through all 50 states, but did many states actually issue protections for renters who were not, say, Section 8 renters or who didn't have federal government dollars helping them subsidize their rent? I mean, I believe New York State had some sort of protection on rent, but what was the landscape nationally there?
It's really a patchwork. So in particular, the larger states that have big renter populations and that were early hit by the crisis, places like New York, California, and Massachusetts, put in place some statewide protections for renters, you know, essentially saying that landlords couldn't file for eviction beyond some date or that filings would be stopped. And I should say that there's sort of been a backdoor protection too, in that in most places, evictions go through the court system, and a lot of state and local governments shut down courts just because they were shutting down all of the activity and not carrying out in-person sort of court cases. So there have been sort of a patchwork of these intentional tenant protections at the state and local level, some unintentional protections with courts being closed, and then the federal financial support. And that's really been very important. What we've seen in the data so far is that most tenants are still able to make at least a partial payment on their rent. And that's essentially because the federal government has been sending out checks to people. When the checks expire, when the unemployment insurance benefits go away, that's going to put people in a very precarious situation.
Elena, homeownership itself has been one of the few means of wealth generation in this country. The majority of wealth in the United States is concentrated among white families, and there's a history to that that involves housing policy. But here we're talking about mortgages and homeowners who might once again be hit with a wave of financial insecurity as we saw more than a decade ago. Are we expecting for Black and Brown homeowners to begin to lose some of that wealth if these upcoming protections are taken away?
The Black and Brown communities that are homeowners today are the most vulnerable of homeowners in this particular pandemic for a variety of reasons. One is one that you mentioned, Tanzina, which is the last crisis of housing and the like lost equity and foreclosures that we saw from homeowners, which disproportionately impacted communities of color. The Black community and the Hispanic community were still recovering from that, hadn't fully recovered. And then this has been just sort of another devastating blow that it's a very different kind of crisis, and it's hitting in a very different kind of way with this massive unemployment that we're seeing, with where jobs are being lost, and in particular markets. And I think the key point here is that a lot of the policy that's happening around homeowner protection has to be focused on keeping people in their homes. We cannot repeat what we saw in 2008 with the number of foreclosures that we saw hitting these families. Keeping people in their homes needs to be sort of the number one objective of all policies. And the Initial CARES Act, which doesn't cover all homeowners with mortgages, it covers those that have really federally backed mortgages. So that's about 69% of all mortgages. There's a large portion that isn't covered, but also the provisions that were put in place were essentially forbearance plans for up to a year, and forbearance has to be repaid. So when you look at families that were financially strapped prior to the COVID crisis, you layer on top of that the unemployment, loss of income that this is bringing, and then you put payments on hold for a number of months that are then going to be due at the end of that period of forbearance. When that money is due, what is going to happen then? And that's the part we're really focused on right now, is what happens to those people in forbearance? How do they do those repayment plans? What programs are going to be in place to support them and help them get on a payment plan that is sustainable for them so that they don't face going into default and ultimately face foreclosure as the option or having to walk away from their home for some reason?
We're talking about home ownership, which anybody who's attempted to buy a home in this country knows how that's not an easy thing to do. You have to have the right amount of money, the right down payment, the right credit score. Let's think about those folks who are still renting right now. If we're talking mm-hmm. about people who have, you know, home ownership ambitions and they happen to still be renters and they're facing eviction, what are the long-term effects of eviction on ultimately? I mean, does that ruin your credit score? Does it have lingering effects longer term than just the moment of being evicted?
The future homeowners, in this country right now are renters, and their struggle is real. And this eviction situation can definitely have damaging effects long term on credit, and then the ability to access credit in the future. It's especially if there are filings or judgments associated with that. And then it's just more than the housing payments. This is affecting all kinds of things in people's lives and their ability to pay their credit card bills, their car loans and other debts that they may have. And you know, if you're unable to pay those bills and you start to get behind and you start to see, a lot of delinquencies across the credit report, there are going to be some implications for credit scores. And this is definitely going to have long term implications that may really delay the ability for people to buy homes.
Jenny, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because there are landlords who have played by the rules, and then there are landlords who may be applying pressure to folks that they expect probably won't be able to pay their rent or their mortgage. Do we know anything about landlords who might be harassing or intimidating tenants to get them out in lieu of a more formal eviction process?
This is an area where we wish that we had better sort of systematic data on it. We rely a lot on tenant advocates to tell us what's going on the ground. Landlords are in a very different financial position depending on who they serve. So one concern that Elena brought up earlier is that, in fact, a lot of landlords, particularly the sort of small mom-and-pop non-professional landlords, don't have particularly thin margins. We've got a lot of landlords who own maybe a 2 or 3 family home that they rent out, and they really rely on the rent payments in order to pay the mortgage and, property taxes and all of the other expenses. So there's some landlords who really just can't give a lot without essentially running into financial difficulties themselves. We do know that some landlords have been voluntarily negotiating payment plans with their tenants. So for many landlords, sort of good faith landlords, kicking somebody out in the midst of a recession doesn't mean that it's going to be easy to find another tenant who can come in and pay the rent. And so a lot of landlords are trying to negotiate, what can we give you in terms of a discount to keep the unit occupied and some cash flow and keep people housed? But we know that some landlords are not acting in good faith, that even where there is an eviction moratorium in place, they may be putting pressure on renters. You know, they can't file and put this through the court system, but they can make things unpleasant for renters and try to get them to leave voluntarily. You know, we always worry about the most vulnerable households. So people who don't speak English, people who are undocumented, people who just don't have social and political power are more vulnerable to being taken advantage of. And those are also the households that are being hit hardest by the financial crisis. From all sides, the labor market impact, the housing instability, the wealth impact, all of these are focused really on the most vulnerable households. And frankly, the public sector just isn't providing enough support and protection.
Elena, this is not happening in a vacuum. All of these connections that we're making right now are sort of really bringing more difficult conversations to the fore in this country, including racial injustice. We're seeing a continual uprising across the country. And I'm wondering, you know, and rent and housing policy seems to have become part of this, a bigger part of the conversation. Are you encouraged by that message sort of resonating with protesters right now?
What we're seeing, and it's not just the pandemic, obviously all these issues of racial justice and policing, these are community issues and neighborhood issues, and everybody can understand them and everybody's seeing them and paying attention because we've all been isolated in our homes and we're watching a lot more and paying more attention. And I think that it's promising, and I do think that this is the time, and it really has started a conversation that I've been hearing personally. And I also think that lawmakers and others are grappling with around just sort of the systemic barriers that have really kept certain communities behind. And how do we start to really unlock all of that? And how do we start to make policy that would really help to get at the most vulnerable populations in a very direct way to unpack all of this? I mean, we just know that this conversation and the tone right now in the country has been just about justice and racism and all the discriminatory things that happen and how ingrained that is in our various systems. And housing is at the epicenter of all this. Where we live and communities and where people are has a lot to do with everything that we're dealing with. And I think it's a really important connection. And the other thing I would just say is that the pandemic itself has been a different kind of disaster, a different kind of crisis. And that the first things that we heard when the pandemic started was stay at home. You know, shelter in place, we got to distance ourselves. So you need a place to be. And that, to me, put housing front and center as an important, really, prescription for this pandemic. It's almost like housing is healthcare. We've been saying that a little bit and hearing that, but this has truly been staying at home. And so you've got to have a safe place to live that's a healthy environment, you know, that you can spend time in and be able to endure and get through this pandemic. And so I think it's a really important connection that is all kind of bringing all these things to a head. And I think it's a really important and promising time for us to really make some bold changes that can really move the dial on the housing policy front, but have a real implication for communities at large.
Jenny, I'll wrap with you here because we've got about a minute left in the segment, but I'm wondering, is there a potential federal intervention right now? Are we expecting the federal government to re-up the CARES Act to help with some of these protections? Are there any states that are considering perhaps extending some of these protections, or is this pretty much it?
There are a lot of ideas floating around out there. We don't know yet what's going to make it through. So the House has already passed another big stimulus bill, the HEROES Act, which would include, I believe, $100 billion in rental assistance. So getting cash directly to households who need it so they can keep paying their rent. The Senate hasn't taken that up yet, and we don't know whether they will. States and cities are absolutely having conversations about whether they should extend the current eviction moratorium and just in general how they're going to cope with this when the courts reopen and evictions can go forward, if there are additional sort of short-term emergency rental assistance or protections, providing more resources for tenants to go through mediation. We're trying to come up with things on a broad scale, but really absent a coherent federal policy for this, not just in the short run. So we're certainly focused on people who have lost their jobs, lost hours, can't pay the rent right now. But a lot of this comes back to the fact that we had housing insecurity before the crisis, that 20% of Americans couldn't pay the rent or the mortgage even before this hit. And at some point, the federal government has to provide appropriate kinds of resources so that everybody can afford a decent quality place to live all the time, not just an emergency. And at some point, we also have to grapple with the fact that local governments have made it hard to build high quality rental housing. And so we have this sort of persistent shortage and high cost of housing that you can't really deal with in the midst of a crisis.
Jenny Schutz is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Elena McCargo is the vice president of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Elena, thank you.
Thank you very much, Tanzina.
This is Matt in Oklahoma. After 3 months of approved forbearance through our mortgage company, we're going to start paying again, but obviously don't have the funds to pay for the 3 months that we've missed as a whole. So now we are curious and nervous and slightly confused about the options going forward.
This is Bridget Shea, and I'm a county commissioner. We are using $10 million of the federal coronavirus relief money to help people pay their rent and mortgage because we know that there will be a housing crisis as a result of the pandemic. So we're making $10 million available starting at the end of June for people to apply for up to 3 months assistance with paying their rent or their mortgages. The last thing we want to do is have an entire new population of homeless people because they can't pay their rent because they've lost their jobs or been harmed from the pandemic.
This is Karen Sitz from Covina, California. I am definitely on furlough from my job. First time in my life that I haven't been working as an adult, and so it's been a little weird. But I am so grateful for the CARES Act that was passed, the additional funding on unemployment. It has made the difference for me as to whether or not I can contribute to the household in a meaningful way. And it has certainly kept my family from having to deal with any evictions.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Tuesday was primary day for three states, Kentucky, New York, and Virginia, and officials in all three have been trying to learn from states that have already had their primaries about how to make voting work during a global pandemic. Let's zoom in on a bluegrass state first. That's the sound of frustrated voters banging on the doors at the only polling station in Louisville. And as predicted, some voters were standing in long lines due to polling station closures. Here to talk us through what happened there is Joshua Douglas, election law professor at the University of Kentucky and author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of people saw the clip that we pulled that sound from of folks banging on the windows and the doors trying to get into a polling station. Tell us what happened there. What was going on there?
Well, that was really unfortunate at the very end of the polling hours last night when basically the polls closed at 6 and there were parking congestion around the expo center. And when they tried to close the doors to the polling place, obviously a handful of voters were still outside. But note that lines actually in Louisville were very short throughout the day up until that moment. And so that was a really terrible end to the closing period. Now, all those voters were allowed to vote eventually.
Josh, we see a lot of folks saying to people, even if your polling place closes at a certain time, 6 p.m. does feel early for a polling place to close, but that as long as you're standing in line, you're able to vote. Is that what happened for those voters yesterday in Kentucky?
Well, there was some confusion about what it means to be standing in line, I guess. And on the ground, the election officials believed that you had to be inside the doors to get in line. And there were people kind of rushing from the parking lot because there was traffic congestion right around the parking lot. So there was an injunction filed. A judge did order them to keep the polls open till 6:30 so that any of those voters who were basically right outside the door were able to get in. But that is the law in Kentucky. If you're in line by 6 o'clock, you're allowed to vote. The question was, were those voters technically in line?
So these questions of whether someone is technically in line, I mean, that sort of feels like we're teetering on thin ice here, because there are lots of concerns across the country, particularly after we saw Georgia voters at their primary a couple weeks ago, just really in terms of allowing folks their ability to vote. And I'm wondering if you can tell us, first of all, why were there so few polling places to begin with? I mean, wasn't there a court ruling that limited the number of polling places?
Well, not a court ruling that limited. There was a challenge asking to open more polling places, and that was denied. What the state did is they moved to no excuse absentee balloting. So anyone was able to vote by mail. And that was a first for the state. Kentucky has very restrictive voting laws. And typically, we don't have any no excuse absentee balloting. So you need to have an excuse to vote by mail. We typically have no early voting, and they opened up 2 weeks of early voting. And the whole goal was to try to minimize the amount of in-person voting needed because of the coronavirus. And so the state was really trying to funnel as many people to these alternative voting processes and at the same time reduce the potential spread of the virus by limiting the number of polling places. Now, it obviously wasn't enough. They should have tried to find a way to open additional polling places, but that was the goal. And what we saw is almost everywhere around the state, with the exception of Lexington, the lines were actually very, very short.
Josh, we won't have much information about results or turnout for the primary. A big reason for that is because of the mail-in ballots. What numbers so far do we have?
Well, we have some data based on the in-person vote in some counties. Lexington released some numbers, especially for the Democratic primary between Amy McGrath and Charles Booker. And so far, Charles Booker looks like he's doing very well with respect to the in-person voting. But those numbers are very preliminary, again, because we have thousands upon thousands of absentee ballots that are still being delivered. And, you know, the other important thing to note is that as long as ballots were postmarked by yesterday for Election Day, they can count once they arrive at the county clerk's office by Saturday via the U.S. Postal Service. So we have a whole lot of ballots still coming in, and we won't know the actual results until next week.
So, Josh, you mentioned the Booker-McGrath race to face Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in November. What did we see there?
Well, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see who wins that race. There was a lot of enthusiasm for Charles Booker towards the end of the campaign. Again, if we just look at the in-person voting totals in some places, and including Lexington, the second largest city, you see a lot of support for Booker. Then the question becomes, you know, how does that look as against Mitch McConnell? I suspect it'll be the most expensive race in the country, whoever wins. You know, Kentucky's a very Republican state with a lot of support for Donald Trump. And with Trump on the top of the ticket, I think Mitch McConnell is going to be difficult to defeat. But, you know, there's a lot of time between now and November, and especially if one of these candidates can have a lot of enthusiasm from the urban centers of the state. We'll see what happens.
Kentucky state legislators also passed a voter ID law earlier this year. Those laws have had their own share of controversy. Some consider them obstructions to getting folks to the polls. What effect did that voter ID law have on this primary? And are we concerned about the law come November for the presidential elections?
The law explicitly does not go into effect till November. So the only effect would be if people had heard about it and were concerned or confused about whether it was in effect and then didn't show up to vote. I am very concerned about its potential effect for November when it's set to be used. I advocated very strongly both to make the law as reasonable as possible, to put some changes, and then also just against the law. as a general matter. Now, I will say that because of some of the details of the law that I and others helped to put in, it's much more reasonable than some of the other photo ID laws around the country, like in Wisconsin and Texas. That said, I still am very concerned about the potential disenfranchising effect, especially to minority communities. There's been a lawsuit filed already, and I'm hopeful that the court will at least put the law on hold for November, because I think it's ridiculous to impose additional hurdles on the right to vote and to expect people to find IDs at a time when we're still trying to socially distance, government offices aren't open, etc.
And also, you mentioned transportation, actually getting to the polls. So we're going to be keeping an eye on Kentucky. Joshua Douglas, election law professor at the University of Kentucky and author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Nazima. This was fun.
Yesterday was also primary day in New York. And so far, the New York Board of Elections is dealing with a surge of absentee ballots unlike anything the state has dealt with before. As of last week, nearly 30,000 New York City residents who requested a ballot still had not received one. And the absentee ballots that have been received won't be counted until after all the in-person votes are tallied. Some of the more notable races we're following include Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's first contest since her election in 2018, and so far, she has a significant lead. Former GOP Rep. Claudia Tenney also has a solid lead up near Syracuse, and in the race between middle school principal Jamal Bowman and longtime New York Democrat incumbent Elliot Engel, Bowman is holding a pretty solid lead. Joining me now is WNYC's City Hall and politics reporter Bridget Bergen. Bridget, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tanzina.
So, when will we get final results?
What are you doing in mid-July, Tanzina?
Got it. Okay.
It's going to be a while. As you said, there are in-person voting from in-person tallies from early voting and primary voting yesterday, but there is this just flood of absentee ballots that still could really influence the margin of some of these races that, you know, we've got some early results for, some trend information, but could these absentee ballots could really change the game. And we're not going to know how many, you know, we're not going to know those results until they start counting them next week.
So we mentioned at the top, Bridget, that there were about 30,000 New Yorkers, at least in the city, who said they hadn't gotten their ballots as of last week. Has that number changed, or what did those folks end up doing?
So it's really interesting, Tanzina. Last week and up through this process, the City Board of Elections has been releasing data around how many people had applied for an absentee ballot and how many of those ballots had been distributed. And so that 30,000 number is based on the most recent data that we got from the City Board of Elections that was as of last Wednesday. So old, a week old. Last night, before the polls closed, before any of the in-person results had been published, the board put up a new data set that was a different set of numbers. And they said that they have distributed more than 765,000 absentee ballots. And so far, they've gotten back about 92,000 of those ballots. Because, of course, they're not going to get back all the ballots they mail out. Not everyone will put them in the mail. Some people will decide to vote in person. But it's a really, you know, that change in how they are reporting that information is troublesome, I think, because it doesn't answer your first question, which is, well, how many people didn't end up getting their ballot? How many people applied and were still waiting? And I can tell you that we put a call out to our listeners and our audience yesterday asking for people's voting experience. And, you know, if you went anywhere near social media, looking at Twitter for New York City, one of the things we saw consistently with stories from people who had applied for what they said, applied for absentee ballots by the deadline that didn't get them. And so that's a data point that I will be pursuing pretty aggressively.
You know, with the understanding that we are in the middle of a global pandemic and that has abated somewhat in New York City, but we're still, you know, in the middle of this. And with that understanding that places may not have been prepared, nobody was prepared for the pandemic, but the New York City and New York State voting apparatus knew that it had problems before the pandemic. We've seen issues at the polls before. Why were they not as prepared, Bridget, as they should have been, pandemic aside, for the surge in absentee ballots? Or is it really just those two things colliding right now?
So Tanzina, one of the things that's complicating here is the Board of Elections, you know, in a place like New York is really, you know, we talk about the Board of Elections, there's a state Board of Elections that oversees the state, but then elections are actually run at the local level. And so that means there are 61 boards of elections across the city, across the state. And that's, you know, that's a lot of room for how to get things a little bit wrong. Most importantly, though, the most important distinction is New York does not have an actual vote by mail system. New York put in some changes because of the pandemic. Governor Cuomo issued some executive orders expanding access to absentee ballots. But that still meant that people had to go through a whole process of applying for that absentee ballot and then getting it back and then filling out the ballot, filling out the absentee ballot oath envelope, and then mailing that back. And then, as I said before, and as we've talked about, those ballots are technically not supposed to be counted until they are received, until the whole process wraps up next week. In a state where you have an actual vote by mail system, there generally is more of a tracking system in place so that once that ballot gets mailed out and the person mails it back, then if a person were to try to go vote in person, they would say, no, actually, you've already voted. You know, you can't vote in person. But here in New York, since it's not a full vote by mail system, you know, if I mailed an absentee ballot, but then yesterday decided, you know what, I'm not sure if I did it right or I've changed my mind, whatever it is, I could have still gone to the polls yesterday and voted. And so that whole sorting process is going to be really complicated. Again, the other part of it is this is on a scale that the state has never had to deal with before. You know, in the presidential primary in 2016, there were about 115,000 absentee ballots statewide. For this presidential primary and state and local contests, 1.7 million voters applied for absentee ballots statewide.
Bridget, that's something I'm thinking the 2020 election is coming up. We've got a minute left in the segment. Will these things be ironed out by the time the presidential election comes up, now that the Board of Elections has a sense for how many people might be voting absentee?
It's a really good question. I think a lot of people are going to be looking at it. But what's important to note is that the changes that were put in place to allow for expanded absentee ballot in access in this election are not in place yet for November. They were executive orders that Governor Cuomo put in place just for this primary. So we'll have to see what system we're going to use for the November general election.
Bridget Bergen is a City Hall and politics reporter at WNYC. Bridget, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
When the $2.2 trillion Federal CARES Act was signed into law at the end of March, it allocated roughly $8 billion to tribal governments. Months later, tribes are still waiting for some of that money to be distributed. Multiple tribes are suing the federal government over how the money has been allocated. According to the tribes involved in those suits, the Treasury Department underfunded them by millions of dollars. But while the court battles over funding are playing out, indigenous communities in the United States are still being hit disproportionately hard by the coronavirus outbreak. Here with me now is Eric Henson, a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation and a research affiliate with the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development. Eric, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So how had the Treasury Department allocated the money to tribal governments so far?
It has basically taken place in two rounds. There was a batch of dollars that went out. Initially, it was based on a population count for the different tribes. And then there was a second round that was based on the number of employees that tribes have, and also a measure of expenditures that tribes undertake each year. And so those two batches, the first batch had about 60% of the money, and the second batch had about 40% of the money. And then there's some dollars that have been set aside pending one of these lawsuits dealing with whether the Alaska Native corporations should be eligible for receipt of some of the funding. And that's the state of play as we speak today.
And you mentioned two of the buckets of funding, if you will. Do we have a sense of how much the initial $8 billion has still not been doled out by the federal government?
My understanding and kind of back of the envelope estimate is it's somewhere between $500 million and $600 million. And that's the set aside for the Alaska Native Corporation litigation. That seems to be set to play out over the coming weeks and months. There was a temporary restraining order that prohibited the Treasury from issuing money to those Alaska Native corporations, but the judge allowed Treasury to hold some aside pending a full litigation of that question.
Let's take a step back just a minute here, Eric, because I think a lot of our listeners may not be as familiar with what's the sort of details here when it comes to the lawsuits. Because funding has been delayed because of lawsuits that tribal governments filed asking to stop some of this funding from going to the Alaska Native corporations. Who are Alaska Native corporations and why do the tribes want to block that funding?
Sure. So the history of the Alaska Native corporations is tied to some legislation that the federal government put in place in the early 1970s. Much of the land in Alaska was subject to land claims by Native people up there at the time. But oil had been discovered on the North Slope, and there were questions about building a pipeline and having that oil production come online. And so Congress put in place this Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And part of that was establishing these different corporations, there were these dozen at the time, and then there's a 13th one that came about later. And so different people up in Alaska are shareholders of these corporations. And so in the initial CARES Act legislation happened, and it mentioned that the Alaska Native corporations might be recipients of some of that money. A number of the tribes, there are currently 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States. A number of those tribes initiated these lawsuits to stop any of the money going to the Alaska Native corporations. And their argument is basically, look, of the 574 federally recognized tribes, there are something like 229 of them that are Alaskan anyway. And these corporations are corporate entities that are not fundamentally tribal governments. And so there's pending dispute about whether the ANCs, they call them, these Alaska Native corporations, will receive those hundreds of millions of dollars or not. There are some other lawsuits about individual tribes claiming that their population was undercounted one way or another. But those have not actually held up the disbursement of those two big buckets of money we talked about. There was a hearing kind of late in the game to halt that second bucket of money being distributed. But the judge who's presiding over these issues ordered Treasury to go ahead and disperse the funds. And so my understanding is those tribes might be able to pursue their individual claims still. But that's, it's smaller dollars on any individual tribal basis than, you know, the billions of dollars that went out in the first bucket tied to population, and then the billions of dollars that went out in the second bucket.
Eric, one of the things, you know, we're seemingly talking less and less, at least at the national level, about coronavirus, and we are not, I'm not hearing as much about how this is affecting the different communities, particularly Native communities. Without this funding, and given the fact that this community has been so hard hit and continues to be hard hit by coronavirus, what do you see as the long-term effect here?
Well, the initial shock to the tribal economies was quite severe, and it was kind of from both ends, right? Tribes are heavily dependent on tribal enterprises for effectively being their governmental tax base. Tribes have never had great luck really levying and collecting taxes. So they engaged in all these enterprises, something like tourist enterprises and gaming enterprises, and my own tribe owns a chocolate factory and various things. And any profits from those enterprises are more or less the tax base for tribal governments. And when the coronavirus first reared its ugly head, virtually all those businesses took a hit. If you were in the tourism industry or gaming industry, you know, all those got shut down. So tribal revenues were immediately impacted. And only now they're starting to come back, you know, in diminished form. At the same time, you had these massive increases in social service demands and healthcare demands, you need to start thinking about like expanding your food pantry and potentially hiring cleaning crews and buying all sorts of PPE. And you had this tremendous revenue fall tied to increased demands, and the tribes really had this shock to their economies as well as their healthcare systems all at the same time.
Where do you see, beyond economics, the cultural loss that the pandemic could represent for certain tribal nations?
Oh, sure. That's a big part of what I think a lot of tribes have been worried about is, you know, take one example, take language retention. Lots of indigenous communities around the world have had tremendous trouble maintaining their native tongues, right? And it's often the case that the oldest among the living population has the best language retention. And coronavirus in particular, when it first came about, you know, was disproportionately affecting the oldest among every town, every community, every population. And so I think just through that one little vignette of like language retention, you could see this tremendous scare that many of your best native speakers are in dire danger from this.
Eric Henson is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation and a research affiliate with the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today, guys. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts on anything we discussed today, please give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave us a message. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.